People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. Fine Music Radio it is, and Rodney Trojan welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Well, I'm sure you recall that very recently we had broadcasts of all five Beethoven piano concertos, which were played as part of the 10th International Summer Music Festival with the Cape Town Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Victor Yampolsky. And the soloist in all five was François Dutoit, celebrating his 50th birthday and treating us to those magnificent works. François Dutoit is my guest on People of Note this week. Welcome, François. And I think, first of all, we have to wish you happy birthday, because your birthday was after the concerts, wasn't it?
Rodney, yes. My birthday was actually on the 7th of March. And I must say that celebration and the wishes that came already at the end of the concerts, that was wonderful, but I felt like I'd aged prematurely a little bit, perhaps, in conjunction with having done the concerts. But the birthday itself was the 7th of March.
Yeah. And you had that lovely moment where they all sang happy birthday at the end of the last concert, after the 5th concerto. Not only the orchestra playing, but the audience sang their hearts out.
I must say that was incredibly overwhelming for me, and I felt quite emotional about that. I'm actually quite shy as a person, and people laugh about that, but I really am. And I felt that this was so special, but I was kind of overwhelmed by it. I didn't quite know what to do.
You looked overwhelmed. You sort of flopped over the piano.
Didn't really know how to deal with this.
One of the first questions I want to ask you is, what made you decide to tackle what for many people is the monument of a cycle of piano concertos? Stylistically, they are so different, and yet there's a stability in them, these five magnificent pillars of the repertoire of Beethoven.
Rodney, I think that Beethoven has always been a central point in my pianistic life. The Beethoven First Piano Concerto, in fact, the first movement was the first concerto that I ever played with an orchestra, and that was with the old K-Pab orchestra for the Youth Festival way back in the early 80s. And I think David Tidbolt was still conducting the orchestra at that stage. And in the course of my life, I'd learned 1, 3, and 5 and played them, especially 3 and 5, quite a few times, actually, considerably more than 1. And at some stage, I just felt that my love for them, every time I'd relearned them, it's so strange. You know, when you study a piece of music, sometimes you can go back to a piece of music if you've played it a couple of times, and you can be a little bit sort of world-weary about looking at the piece with fresh eyes. But with the Beethovens, it was never the case. Every time I came back to them, I really loved them. And I thought to myself, I really need to learn number 2 and 4 before I, sort of pop my clogs. And I thought, well, okay, this would be a chance maybe to do that. I wonder whether anybody would be interested. And that was how the whole 5 came along, yeah.
So had you not, in fact, played 2 and 4 before?
Never before. Those were the
Goodness
first time I
gracious.
Played 2 and 4 in my life, yeah.
That's actually quite, I don't know whether to say it's an admission or not. Because, I mean, as you say, when you come to the pieces that you know so well, that was going to be one of my questions. How do you look at it with fresh eyes?
Well, I do go back to studying the piece as if I hadn't seen the piece for a while, so that you really look at the piece from a point of view of if you're learning the notes again. In pure labor-like terms, it involves really slow practice. What I call picking out sections, working individually at areas, never just playing through the piece. It's really something that you have to sit there and work as if you've never seen the piece before. Mm-hmm. So that was for me the whole idea of that. And then, of course, with 2 and 4 being brand new, I knew them. I've taught them, but I've never played them. I felt that I really had to put that extra bit into get them, first of all, under the fingers and then really into the head.
And how difficult a task was that with 2 and 4?
2 and 4, I think the task that lay ahead of me was, I thought to myself at this stage, usually I'm a little bit of a procrastinator, but this time I wasn't. I realized that I had to play 1, 2, and 4 on the Wednesday. So 2 and 4, the two new ones were both going to be on the same night. I'd better be prepared. And so I actually, I just sat and graphed it at the piano. I spent 6-7 hours a day at the piano for at least a month and a half, 2 months before the concerts. And before that, for 2 or 3 months, at least a couple of hours already, you know, just in the work.
And they are so stylistically different, aren't they?
Absolutely.
I mean, two especially from number four, because number four on its own is very different from the other five. And number two, as we know, he wrote it first, so
that's
it's
right,
got
yeah.
that more classical feel.
Well, I think that that was part of the journey for me in these Beethovens, that I felt, for me it was really, in a selfish sort of way, it was really for me such a pleasure to work at them. I never once thought, oh boy, I wish I was on, you know, the beach or something like that, or, I don't know, you know, Clifton Forth or something. I really did feel that it was a journey for me to sit there and work at these pieces, and I enjoyed that because I had to create my own sense of identity for each of the concertos. And I was acutely aware of the second being almost Mozartian in approach, even though it is Beethoven. One can't get away from it. And then this glorious fourth piano concerto, which is truly such a phenomenal work.
Mm-hmm. That must have been a joy to get to
it
know.
It was an absolute joy.
And
to perform it and to work at that, it was continually for me. I would get up in the morning, and sometimes, you know, we get up and we go to the piano and we're like, oh, ho-hum, you know, another day at the office. But this was never the case with the fourth, or even the second, really. I mean, mm-hmm. I find some things in the second absolutely excruciatingly beautiful, you know, really wonderful moments.
Like the slow movement.
Slow movement.
For example.
But in a way, that was for me the pinnacle of this whole thing, was being able to learn two new pieces and to combine it with three old favorites and old friends, really. Those
and
one,
yet,
two,
as
five.
You say, to bring a freshness of to approach freshness. To those three famous ones.
Yes, yeah.
Well, there's lots more I want to ask you about your process of getting these under your fingers, Francois, but let's have your first piece of music now.
Yes, you know, I'm a child sort of pre-technology, and I remember the excitement when the first CD player started to come out, because in those days we all had records and LPs, and, you know, they invariably got scratched and sound wasn't so fantastic. And this whole idea of listening to a piece of music on a form of technology that took away all the hiss and the scratches and all of that was very exciting. And I remember going out, and the first CD that I bought was the Vierletzte Lieder by Richard Strauss with Jesse Norman singing, and completely bowled over by the sound. Gosh. Also because just the recording itself, the sound of the orchestra and the acoustic that it was recorded in, felt like that you were sitting in the middle of the hall, just, you know, absorbing this wonderful music. And of course the third one by Schlafengehen is truly my favorite. I think it's many people's favorite. I mean, all four are fantastic, but I wanted to choose that as my first CD that I ever bought.
What does one say, Francois, after such beautiful music and such a performance? Jesse Norman with the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, conducted by Kurt Mazur, and the third of the four last songs by Richard Strauss, Beim Schlafengehen. What a different Strauss from the Salome we heard a few weeks ago.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It was the first choice of my guest on People of Note on Fine Music Radio this week, the pianist Francois Dutoy, who's enjoying all the acclaim of the five Beethoven piano concertos that he's just performed with the Cape Town Philharmonic. And there was a lot of acclaim. Do you read crits, Francois?
Rodney, really, not really, actually. I mean, I don't actually go out consciously and buy papers. You know, I do the news, just what I can see on the internet or so. But people were very kind and saved clippings for me of the crits. And there was a lovely photo that I saw that appeared in the Cape Town, which was really quite wonderful, because I love the look of the City Hall. You know, it's such a fantastic hall, and with the orchestra on stage. And that was very special to see that, yeah.
Now, Francois, you were talking about preparing these five magnificent works. And one of the things I wondered, you're a teacher, you're a lecturer, you're immersed in academia as well.
Yeah.
But I know that first and foremost, you're a performer, aren't you, I think?
Well, I try to keep the performing side going, yeah.
Yeah. But when you are studying these pieces, do you have any sort of mentor? Do you have anyone listening to you? Or do you work, do you work entirely on your own interpretation and style and view?
You know, Rodney, what I often do is that I, and this is something I always speak to my students about, is that I first work really to get I do what I call the groundwork. You have to do the fundamental work. You have to get the notes learned. You have to approach the piece that you feel that just from a technical point of view, you know exactly what you're going to do with the piece. When it comes to the interpretation point of view, yes, I listen to a few different recordings in the beginning, but then I don't listen to anything afterwards, because I don't want to copy somebody, want to do reproductions. No, or influence unnecessarily. I need to know stylistically. You know, sometimes one can look at a trill and say, oh, does it start on the upper note or on the note or something, and I'll ask my colleagues what they think. But, you know, over the years, one realizes there's no direct line to any of these composers. So it's always up. It's just what feels the most comfortable and what sounds the best. But then what I did do with the Beethovens was that I did get a few close friends. James May, Professor James May especially, was incredibly kind. He traveled out to my house, and I would play to him a concerto or two, you know, just go through the solo parts. Also other friends of mine that I would get together. I probably did it about three or four times that I played to people, and then I went through for two and four. I went through to the college one day, and Albie von Skalkwyk kindly played to me on the second piano, because that's the one thing that one forgets about when practicing. It's just, you know, I'm aware of what the orchestra is doing, but sometimes I'm not quite certain when am I supposed to come in or when am I not. So those are things that you have to brush up on towards, you know, the end, just to know exactly what's happening. And he kindly went through it with me as well. And
playing the orchestra part on the piano.
Doing the orchestra part on the second piano. And that helped tremendously. So, and then I asked him, I said, you know, please, Albie, if I'm doing anything, you know, sacrilegious, please tell me. And, you know, I spoke about him, had a few questions to ask. And it's all part of the wonderful thing of new. You know, I don't think that I go in there with the idea that I know all the answers. Sometimes you're doing something and it doesn't work, and you need to find out. You have another pair of ears. Yeah.
And yeah, and someone would say something and it would open a whole new world, possibly.
Absolutely.
To you.
Yeah,
because with those scores, there's not too much controversy about them and additions,
no,
is there?
No, not so much, no. I must say they're pretty, even with it, it doesn't even have to be the Hendler-Urtext, which is sort of the Bible of music scores. It can even be the Schirmer additions or whatever. They often do have footnotes of what things can be in. I think what is more controversial about the Beethoven sometimes is the fact that some of the passages that he wrote, the people that have given out the editions have added in or said that this is what it could have sounded like purely on the basis of the keyboard having run out of space in Beethoven's time. Mm-hmm. So, and those were things that I questioned. In the fourth concerto, there are passages which he wrote differently because he just didn't have enough notes. And we have the now much more extended keyboard. But then I went and I just listened to recordings for those things. And I heard, I thought to myself, you know, if Pariah does it, if Gilels does it, you know, who am I now to quibble about and say, oh, gosh, no, I've got to be purist. I've got to do exactly what he wrote. Because I understand, and I think, had Beethoven been around, he would have written it like that.
Yes. But then I almost think that destroys the point, because he didn't have a bigger piano.
Yes.
So what he wrote when he was writing the third or the fourth was whether he wanted a bigger piano is beside the point. He wrote a magnificent piece for a piano that size.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So why would an editor then go and fiddle around with it?
Well, sometimes the editor looks and he sees, oh, this is the pattern, and he wants to, in the recapitulation, perhaps repeat. We always repeat that sort of pattern, but it's obviously sometimes a fifth up or whatever. And then you have to think, what would he have written sometimes like that? There are places where he's done. So one looks at that. Other editors' markings, phrasings and stuff, I always ignore.
Yeah.
Fingering as well. I don't know what they had. I think they had sort of mutated fingers sometimes because I've never understood some of the fingerings in the pizzas. You know, I'm a great one for sitting with a pencil there and writing my own fingering in because I think it really helps with the learning process. That helps.
And what about, is there any controversy? I'm sure I read or heard or seen or whatever, something about pedaling. You've got to be careful with Beethoven's pedaling.
There's the pedaling thing. There's those pedals marks that he pedals for four bars right through. And, you know, there's, of course, there's the two opposing views. People say, no, that the piano was a lot thinner in those days, and therefore if you put the pedal down for four bars, it didn't mush as much as a grand piano. One of the great things about studying in Germany was that I got a chance to go to Bonn. At one stage we were on an expedition, then I actually played on Beethoven's piano. And when you put the pedal down for four, I tried the third piano concerto, the middle movement. I tried that, and I put the full pedal down for four bars, and it does mush. So I'm like, well, if it mushes here, then obviously it wants a mushy sound. If it gets too much, of course, you have to take into consideration the acoustic you're playing in. It's different from your lounge to the city hall. One can advocate sort of half pedals or very what I call flutter pedal just to try. But that sound that he wanted, that slightly, not from this earth kind of sound of floating music that sort of floats into one another, is obviously what he wanted to get. So I'm not going to sit there and pedal it correctly as if I'm at high school, you know, sort of every bar cleaned in every sound. It needed to be slightly intermeshed and linked.
As
like
you
that.
Say, mushed.
Yes, slightly mushed.
Okay, but now, look here, your next piece of music is a bit of a surprise.
Oh, yes. People always say to me, what's your favorite piece of music and which composer? I don't actually have any specific person. I love all music. And I was extremely lucky that as a student, I was also involved in sort of playing background music at, in those days, I think it used to be the Cape Sun and the Palm Court. I played there with the violinist Nikolai Petrovich, fantastic violinist, but incredibly temperamental. And he would sort of play amongst the tables and disappear, and sometimes I couldn't even hear him. But boy, oh boy, did it teach me how to follow. And then in between, I would have to play my own stuff, and I really developed a love for all kind of music, from the musicals, from Cole Porter, right through to present day. And I chose this particular song because this singer, Barbara Streisand, is who I really consider one of the greatest singers of the popular music genre that's ever lived. Her attention to phrasing, detail, her sense of style, her sense of the dramatic in the music, but also the sense of just the feeling that she can create and the emotive communication that she can do. I think it's wonderful.
Absolutely agree with you.
And one of the most, I know it's a very popular song, but Sending the Clowns, I just think she does so stupendously well. So I chose Barbara Streisand's a live recording of her doing Sending the Clowns.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you with midair, sending the clowns. Isn't it bliss? Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. Where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I'd start opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair. Sure
deserved applause, hey Francois, for Barbara Streisand, that lovely song Send in the Clown, Stephen Sondheim's music.
Yes.
The choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, brought to you by Peter Green Productions, Francois Dutoy. We're still talking about that fantastic, look, it was a remarkable two evenings, Francois, for us in the audience, and I gather for our listeners, because as you know, we broadcast the season live on Fine Music Radio, and we had a remarkable response. It was a remarkable experience, so thank you.
Thank you very
much. And you've explained quite a lot about how you worked on these pieces at home, the five Beethoven piano concertos, but then you come to the week of the rehearsal, then you're in the City Hall with the orchestra and the conductor, and presumably a lot of discussion has to go on between you and Victor about tempi, rubato, all that sort of stuff.
Well, Rodney, you know, it was strange because when the idea of the five Beethoven first came and Louis spoke to me, I thought, oh, it was going to be over perhaps 3 weeks, you know, sort of two this week, two the next week, and one the last week. When he said two nights, of course, I, you know, had to rush for the Valium. but at the end, you do get into a zone of how you're going to do that. Mm. And I realized that what was going to be critical was going to be that first day that we had. I only had the Tuesday to rehearse all five of them with Victor. And then the Wednesday we did a dress rehearsal for the three that night, and the Thursday a dress rehearsal for the two that night. So the Tuesday we did all five. We started at 10 and ended at 4:15 or something like that. I was extremely lucky to have somebody like Victor who has so much wealth of knowledge of conducting these pieces. And what was so sweet about him was he told me of a performance that he'd gone on tour with Beethoven for. I think it was John Ogden, he said, and they'd done something like 5 or 6 performances. And he said every night John Ogden changed something, cut a bar or added a bar or something. He said, don't worry, I will catch you no matter what. And when a conductor says that to you, automatically you just feel more at ease. So the psychological implication of him really being there as a support and understanding what you're going through helps tremendously. So that when it comes down to the things like the tempi, we didn't talk that much. In the beginning, we would play through a movement, and then he would go back and he'd say, all right, now what do you think tempi-wise? And I'd say, perhaps we need it a little faster, or, you know, a little slow, whatever, and I need a bit more support here, or what do you suggest? What is going to be the easiest for that? With the Beethoven's, often what is tricky is those runs. You know, when the piano's going, doing a sort of a big flat chromatic run, you know, I'm too busy gawking at what I'm doing with my fingers to look up and see whether he's going to catch me or whether I should indicate. So, and he was so incredible with that. He
famously
just knew.
Like the first movement of the fifth.
That's right, yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He would just sort of look over and, you know, I could just see out of the corner of my eye, you know, your reflexes work over time. Mm. I could just see the hand going up and I thought, okay, we're going to be in time. We're going to be absolutely there. But it is not always that you get somebody who is so experienced and supportive. And that was fantastic to work with him like
and
that.
And also Victor, here we're doing a bit of a ray for Victor as well, because the balance he achieved between the piano and the orchestra was so good. In that, you know, Beethoven has all that beautiful woodwind writing in the concertos.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how that came up, you were probably too busy playing to listen out.
Well, you know what, now I do listen to the orchestra because it's so you know, we think that it's a solo, you know, you're playing the solo piano, but you're not. You're doing, it's just an enlarged form of chamber music when you're doing a concerto. And it's incredibly stupid to think that you are the, you know, soloist star kind of thing and the orchestra is just the band behind you. No, this is a team effort. And
especially in Beethoven.
Especially in Beethoven. And you feel the support of the orchestra when they realize that you are also respecting what they are doing. And I loved the interaction that I could get between the woodwind sections or between the violins or even the cello, whatever. You know, for me, that is what it's all about. It's making music.
Because
it's not me just performing. You know.
In the first three, there's the long exposition, isn't there?
Orchestral
exposition.
Yes.
Especially number one, which, and then suddenly number four starts with you on your own, and number five with that huge cadence-like passage.
Absolutely.
So how different they all are as well.
Well, I can tell you with those long expositions, and I, you know, this is something that I often told to only to friends, but quite often it's happened that by the time the orchestra is halfway through the exposition, your mind starts to play games. I'm like, what note do I start on?
Are you serious?
Absolutely. And then suddenly it just kicks in. When the moment comes, you know, thank goodness for muscle, you know, reflex.
Francois, have you seen that lovely YouTube clip of Maria João Pires in Amsterdam?
Yes, that's right.
I think just with Ricardo Chailly, they were playing a Mozart lunchtime concert.
That's right.
And he started a concerto, and it was the wrong Mozart concerto.
Yes, and she just jumped in and played
She just jumped in and played it.
They obviously pay her well.
Yes. Now, look, how do you memorize these things? How do you memorize 5 Beethoven piano concertos? Someone said you played 85,000 notes, which I don't think is the point.
Yes,
the point is where the order in which
that I got them in the right order.
And also the phrasing, the nuances.
I do a lot of studying of the music. I'm lucky. I think I'm very blessed that I've my memory. Yes, we all have little memory lapses and stuff like that. And there were little things that one maybe went wrong in each of the pieces. But that's the joy of live performances. But generally, I have a sound memory to do that. I memorize not only by muscularly memorization, I analyze. I have perfect pitch, so I can do the oral memorization as well. The visual as well, it's incredibly important that I know what I'm doing in the feel. And then I do spend quite a lot of time away from the piano, just with the music on my lap. so that I can hear it in my head and that I can see what's on the page. And the final stages of the memorization is usually when I put the music flat on the piano lid, not down, you know, standing up. And then I sort of start to play through and I say, oh, I know this. Ooh, I don't know that so much. Let me go and have a look. And then I can look at the music. And that's how you work it.
Mm-hmm. And was there ever a time, you have to be honest now,
yeah,
in these five concertos over those two nights where for a moment you thought, oh dear, which concerto am I playing?
No. Okay. I'll be completely honest, not. No. I did have the wherewithal to think which. Sometimes I was wondering which note to play next, but not which concerto. I did sort of know what was happening there.
Well, now you've chosen a fantastic pianist as your third piece of music, Francois.
Yes.
Tell
me
about this.
You know, my exposure to Christian Zimmermann was also at a relatively early age when I was still a student. And I was always completely amazed by this such nobility in the piano playing. There's no histrionics, there's no circus act, it's all about the music, it's all about what the piano sounds like, this wonderful sound that he gets from the piano. And I can say quite honestly that I have many, many pianists that I love for many different works, the Argerichs, the works. I love Galel's sound, I love Maria João Perez, but Zimmermann for me is one of these people that every time he plays something, I really listen to it and I think to myself, what a fine musician he is when he's doing that. And of course, one of my favorite conductors all time, recording conductors, was Leonard Bernstein.
Yeah, yeah.
He just brought something so special. Karajan was always great. We always knew it would be efficient, but Bernstein brought the mensch
and an
in
edge.
One.
There was an edge, wasn't there?
Absolutely, yeah.
So this now is the scherzo, really, the second of four movements
The
Brahms' second piano concerto.
That's right.
Recorded live in Vienna.
Recorded live in Vienna, which is even more amazing because you don't hear one split note. I think I might hate him for that.
Let's see how much of the movement we can fit in.
Super.
That's fantastic music, let alone the sound that was made there and Absolutely. The performance. That was the second movement of the Piano Concerto No. 2 by Brahms with Christian Zimmermann and the Vienna Philharmonic conducted by the great Leonard Bernstein. The choice of my guest on People of Note this week, François du Toit. François, we've spent virtually the whole program talking about your Beethoven cycle, and I sort of don't feel like apologizing because it was such an event. And I think surely it was even a milestone in your life.
Absolutely.
To do those five.
It was the biggest thing that I've ever done in that I can remember. Well, no, I know for a fact that it was the biggest sort of mountain that I've had to climb. Lovely mountain, but still a mountain.
And there are lots of things we could talk about, and you're very well known to Cape Town audiences, and you're loved by Cape Town audiences, I've noticed since I've been down here. Yeah. And so I also gather that you're on sabbatical at the moment,
yes.
which possibly helped with the Beethoven as well. So what do you do now that the Beethoven is finished? What do you do when you're away from the piano and all those notes?
Well, you know what? I do take time off a little bit, like about a week or so afterwards. I had to get away from the piano just really to recharge the batteries. But the sabbatical is there for research purposes. In my specific field, it's for creative output. So I have got concerts lined up that we're going to do, or that I'm going to do. A few solo concerts. I'm also busy with my doctorate demos, which I hope to complete this year.
My goodness.
I'm still got long teeth about having to do all the writing, because as I think I explained to you once before, you know, for every paragraph I write, I think I could have learned another bar of music, and it's a constant weighing up of what is more important for me.
And there's lots of writing, isn't there,
for a PhD? Yeah, there is a lot. And, you know, you've got to know how to dot the T's and cross the I's and that, all of that nonsense. But for the rest of it, actually, I also take that. Yes.
Or even dot the I's and cross the T's.
Yes. That sort of explains my footnote ability. but, you know, for the rest of it, I'm pretty much a homebound person. I enjoy being at home. I have two wonderful German Shepherd dogs that I love to take for walks. I'm very lucky. I have a very supportive partner in my life for the last 19 years. And one of my great passions is really going to the bush. You know, I love it. I absolutely do. We hop in the car at 12 o'clock at night, and we drive from here to Nelspruit in one foul swoop, 2,000 kilometers, and then we go and stop there, and then we go to the Kruger Park, and we spend 5 days. Or we'll go off to the Kalahari and spend a week there.
And does that kind of... Not only, obviously, it gets you away with the piano, but does it clear your mind as well?
Absolutely. You know what? That wonderful, blessed relief of not having cell phone reception. Mm. It is something that is quite priceless, actually, nowadays. And you can just escape from everything that's going on. You know, I mean, one's so inundated in this modern day with news coming at you from all angles, and sometimes not that pleasant, that sometimes it's really good just to go and enjoy living, you know. This is life. It's not a rehearsal. One has to, you know, enjoy it and embrace it.
Now that
it.
You're 50,
I have to enjoy it even faster.
You have to enjoy it faster. But François, some people have asked me, you know, did we record those concerts?
Yes.
Obviously, they recorded for the SABC, but not for sale. But would you ever consider recording them for commercial release?
Well, they were recorded on camera, actually, by very good friends of mine who have a television company, and they actually did that as their birthday present. Homebrew is the company, and we're going to see how they came out. If there's not too many train crashes, then we could perhaps even release it in a DVD format, combined with the sound from the people that recorded the sound parts. So it would do that. If there are too many crashes, then one would have to record that. But of course, that is an expensive process nowadays.
It is. You've got to get the whole process going again. You've got to get Victor back.
You've got to do that.
Because it would have to be with the same team.
It would have to be the same team.
Especially after what you said about Victor and how well you worked with him.
Absolutely. And then you've got to get the whole orchestra together. It becomes, you know, in this day and age where people don't even really sell CDs, you know, everything's online.
It's
incredibly expensive to do that.
And François, you've got seconds left, but you're a good chamber musician. We have not spoken about your chamber music. You love chamber music, don't you?
Well, I absolutely adore working with other people with music.
Yeah, rather than the solo recital.
The solo stuff, I understand that, and I like that. I've never been somebody who feels that it's about me. It's not. It's about the music, and I think the chamber music, the concerto playing, that is, for me, just as important, and I'm always very happy to do that and enjoy it so much. Yeah.
You stunned us over those two nights, Francois. There you are. That's my compliment to you, because we have to stop now. We'll have to have People of Note with Francois du Toit Part 2 sometime soon. But you enjoy your sabbatical, and I think you have a bit of a surprise for your last piece of music. So you'll have to explain yourself, maestro.
Yes, well, you know, as I said, people think that I go home and sort of listen to Bach and, you know, Beethoven. It's not true. I actually even have KFM now and then on in the car. So but FMR is predominantly on. But I do have a very soft spot for, you know, numbers from the Cole Porter, Zontime, those people. And this particular CD was one that I bought just by chance. It's actually by the pop group Westlife, which is a very well-known boy band. And they released a CD, and it's called Allow Us to Be Frank. And it's all a retake and of their own interpretations of old Frank Sinatra popular songs. And the one that I've chosen, the one that I really like the most out of these, although I like them all actually, is Smile. And so I'd like to just play out with that.
We'll end with a smile. Francois, thank you for being here. Thank you for letting us in on a lot of secrets about your work. And thank you especially for enriching our lives over those two nights at the Cape Town City Hall.
Rodney, thank you. That's incredibly sweet of you to say that. Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Peter Turin and Kickstart present Stephen Sondheim's musical thriller, Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. A wickedly funny and decadent evening at the theatre starring Jonathan Rocksmith and Sharon Williams-Ross as the legendary barber and his cohort. Only at Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay from the 19th of February. Book now for the closest shave you will ever know.